Well, good evening, everyone. It's such a pleasure to welcome such a tremendous audience to this year's Hilleman Lecture and to recognize the incredible expertise, wisdom, and knowledge of Dr. Nancy Cox, a friend and colleague for many years. Dr. Cox is a scientist, but she's also a public health heroine. She joined the CDC in 1975, just in time to learn everything that needed to be learned about the 1976 swine flu affair. She has been the director of the CDC's WHO Collaborating Center for Influenza, advising the world on vaccine strain selection, and training a real generation of laboratory scientists on the ins and outs of this fascinating virus. In 1991, she became the influenza branch chief, and for the last several years, she's been director of CDC's influenza division, with a couple hundred staff under her leadership who are really premier leaders in the field. Nancy has been recognized with CDC's highest science award, the Charles Shepard Award, 5 different times. I can tell you this because I was competing with her several of those times. She has published several hundred articles, and she's not a fair-weather friend to influenza like a lot of us in this audience. She has been battling this virus for the duration. In 2006, she was named one of Time Magazine's 100 people who shape the world. More impressive than that is that at the gala evening event, which she attended to be recognized, she was featured in the New York Times On the Town style section. It was a lovely red gown, and Nancy looked marvelous. She also won the 2006 Service for America Medal for the Federal Employee of the Year. Recall this was all before our pandemic. Now, if you have to go through a pandemic again, and I hope none of us ever have to, this is the one person that you want in your foxhole. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Nancy Cox.
Thank you very much, Anne, for that very generous introduction. Only you would remember that we made the New York Times style supplement, style magazine. So good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's really my honor and privilege to present the 2010 Geraldine Lynn Hilleman Lecture. And I'm going to be talking about the H1N1 influenza pandemic, the virus, and the vaccines. You can't understand the virus without understanding the vaccines, without understanding the virus. Many microbiologists and vaccine enthusiasts are much more familiar with the names Jenner, Pasteur, Salk, and Sabin than Hilleman. But Maurice Hilleman's legacy is truly remarkable. You heard a bit about it earlier, but understanding Maurice Hilleman requires understanding something about his background. He was born in Miles City, Montana, where he was raised on a farm. And I found that he and I had two things in common. We both were raised on a farm, and we both helped raise chickens. However, that's where we diverge. He credited much of his success to working with chickens, while I learned to loathe the animals. He went on to develop approximately 40 vaccines, played a key role in developing 8 of the recommended childhood vaccines, discovered or co-discovered hepatitis A, SV40 viruses, and several adenoviruses and rhinoviruses. And as you've heard, he was a key researcher in the identification of the H2N2 Asian pandemic virus, which I only suffered from. And as was stated before, he's often credited with saving more lives than any other scientist of the 20th century. I knew Maurice Hilleman and respected him immensely. And this is how I want to remember him, as a vaccinologist and microbiologist extraordinaire. Now I'll go on with discussing influenza and the challenges that it puts in front of us every year, and certainly this last year was no exception. It was a very challenging year indeed. So there are several presentation themes, actually three, that I want to emphasize. To emphasize them, because what we really need to do is to pull the detection of an emerging influenza virus closer to the emergence and pull the vaccine availability closer to the disease, peak of the disease. So we have a lot of challenges for early detection of novel viruses, both with epidemic and pandemic potential. And we know now what we need. We need common detection platforms for pathogen detection, respiratory pathogen detection. And we have some that we're working very hard on now. We also need funding and partnerships, including those with our veterinary colleagues, to identify newly emerging influenza viruses in animals. And of course, our goal will be realized if we're able to do this, because we'll be able to detect earlier the emergence of whatever novel influenza virus causes the next pandemic. We also have a number of challenges for vaccines. We need faster development and earlier availability. So we know that we need to get these vaccine viruses growing better. That was one of the major stumbling blocks of having the vaccine available before disease peaked. So for future pandemics, we can actually prepare a library of truly high-growing vaccine candidates and have them production ready. We can also stockpile some of the reagents that are necessary for testing these vaccines. And then I would also like to emphasize the great importance of partnerships within HHS, of course with the states, with industry, USDA, DOD, USAID, and our other global partners. So we'll start with an influenza virus primer. And I know this looks a bit like raspberries and blueberries on the surface of this virus particle. But what this cartoon shows is that the blue projections from the surface of the virus particle are hemagglutinin. Remember that the hemagglutinin is the most important protein of influenza viruses, and it is the protein against which antibodies, protective antibodies, are made. The neuraminidase is shown in red, and these little knob-like structures also induce some protective antibody, but the antibody is much less important in detecting from disease. In the center of the virus particle, you have the nucleic acid surrounded by protein, and it is there in the form of individual gene segments. So, what are we facing when we face influenza viruses? Well, we're facing the emergence of pandemics starting in 1918. We do have the virus that caused the 1918 virus, thanks to Jeff Taubenberger, Terry Tumpy, and their colleagues. And once that pandemic virus is introduced into the population, if it becomes established, it then begins to evolve. And it circulates and continues to cause epidemics of disease until a new pandemic emerges and crowds it out, as the Asian influenza pandemic did in 1957. We had the emergence of the Hong Kong influenza pandemic in 1968. And then when Russian influenza re-emerged in 1977, we expected that it might actually crowd out H3N2, the Hong Kong flu. But it didn't. Why it didn't remains somewhat of a mystery, but we have a fairly good idea why. And then during the 90s, late 90s, and through to the present time, we've had the emergence of viruses from the avian reservoir, which have entered into the poultry population and which have caused human infections. And we've had to make some pandemic vaccines against these viruses just in case. And then, of course, now we have the emergence of the 2009 H1N1 influenza pandemic virus, and we don't know, will it crowd out seasonal H1N1? Well, it looks like it's going to do so, but it looks less likely to be able to crowd out the H3N2 viruses. So there are just some very unique features of influenza vaccines. These unique features are true not only for pandemic vaccines, but also for seasonal vaccines. The influenza vaccine target is really a set of rapidly changing seasonal viruses and unpredictable pandemic viruses. The immunity acquired from vaccination is strain-specific, that is targeted to one antigenic variant for each vaccine component. Broadening this cross-protection has remained a challenge. It's something we've been working on, but we have not conquered it yet. The oil and water adjuvants, which have been used by our European colleagues, appear to be our best bet in so far in broadening the cross-protection. Now, the holy grail of a universal vaccine is terribly elusive in spite of considerable effort on the part of many brilliant scientists to make this a reality. Therefore, it is a race against time to detect the emergence and spread of new influenza variants and to provide vaccine prior to disease. From a vaccine manufacturer's point of view, production of influenza vaccines is a high risk and high stress endeavor, just like tracking influenza viruses is for us. Now, the foundation for influenza vaccine formulation is the World Health Organization's Global Influenza Surveillance Network, with 131 national influenza centers in 120 countries around the globe. In addition, there are four WHO collaborating centers, one of which is here in Atlanta. These laboratories are very, very busy each year collecting influenza viruses, monitoring change with not terribly sophisticated techniques for most labs, but some labs are very sophisticated in the way they look at influenza viruses, and then selecting a subset of those viruses to send to the WHO collaborating centers, which then provide information to WHO about what viruses should be chosen to be included in vaccines. So what do the experts actually think about when they're making recommendations for what should be included in influenza vaccines in February for the Northern Hemisphere vaccine for the following year, and in September for the Southern Hemisphere vaccine for the next season? So the first question we ask is, are there new antigenic variants? And we use very precise antigenic and genetic characterization of all of the viruses that we receive to make this determination. If we find a new variant, it isn't enough to say, oh, well, we have a new variant, naturally we need to put it in the vaccine. We have to actually monitor them and make sure that they are spreading and causing human disease and outbreaks. And then we ask the question, are the current vaccines able to induce antibodies to the new variants? And we use human sera to make this evaluation. And then we have to ask very practical questions. Are there new variants useful for vaccine production? So we have to have a virus that's been isolated in eggs. Most of the laboratories that are doing surveillance actually use cell substrates for virus isolation. So there's a lot of work that goes on to make egg isolates. And then do we have high growth resortins that the vaccine manufacturers can use to make the enormous amount of vaccine that's required? What we find is that we're always running out of time in our surveillance and vaccine cycles. Just as an illustration of how time critical our decision making is, we actually have to make the decision for what will be included in the vaccine at the time when the arrow is shown and the hammer is pounding. This shows the timeline for the 2007-2008 influenza vaccine season. And we can see that at the time we had to make the vaccine strain selection, we had some H3N2 viruses, some H1N1 viruses, and some influenza B viruses circulating in the United States. Vaccine production actually began before we made the decision, because vaccine manufacturers manufacture on risk. And then you have to realize that this is what happened in the influenza season after we made the decision. So there's a huge amount of information that we do not have about what's going on during that season, and we are making predictions about what will circulate the following year based on global data. Now, the greatest influenza vaccine challenge is gearing up production for a pandemic. In this case, the pandemic that was known as the swine flu pandemic, in spite of our best efforts to call it something else. So we've been preparing for the next pandemic since 2004, pretty intensively. But our preparation was really shaped by the H5N1 experience, along with previous pandemics and epidemics, which tended to emerge from Asia. This sort of shaped our global expectations. And our planning for H5N1 really dominated, and H5N1 was viewed to likely be a fairly severe pandemic if it emerged. So we were focusing our planning efforts on a 1918-like scenario. Now, preparing global surveillance and diagnostic capability and vaccines for a pandemic is challenging because the virus is the problem. So it's the virus, stupid. And the virus is always making us feel very stupid. So we have 16 known subtypes of hemagglutinin and 9 of neuraminidase, which are undergoing constant evolution and reassortment in nature. Most diagnostic tests do not differentiate subtypes, a problem that was faced by our Mexican colleagues in trying to determine what was going on early on in Mexico. And there is a need for more very rapid development of vaccine viruses and a quicker ramp up for vaccine production. So where do these new influenza A viruses come from? Aquatic birds are the reservoir for all HA and NA subtypes. And you pretty much have seen this slide before, and we know that those viruses get transmitted to domestic poultry, where they can mutate and then be transmitted to humans, to pigs, and so on. And we have some really interesting examples of transmission from host to host, such as the equine influenza that was transmitted to dogs a few years ago and has become endemic in dogs. So the influenza viruses are evolving, both at the individual gene segment level. Remember, I showed you the individual genes inside the virus particle. And there is very rapid mutation of influenza virus genes due to the fact that the replication is undertaken by RNA-dependent RNA polymerase, and there's no mechanism for correction of errors. And there's approximately one mutation per genome replication. And so when you have a virus that's replicating at the rate of influenza viruses, moving from host to host, multiple cycles of replication in each individual, you have an enormous number of mutations that occur. In addition to this simple type of mutation, there are also insertions and deletions of nucleic acids in the genes. And we know particularly the insertions that occur in the high-path avian influenza viruses, such as the H5N1 bird flu. Then we have another complication because antibody selection in the host population causes pressure due to previous infection or vaccination, and therefore we have antigenic drift in the hemagglutinin and neuraminidase. We have a huge host diversity and geographic diversity, particularly for some of the avian influenza viruses. So if we look at how quickly that hemagglutinin on the surface of the protein evolves, we can see evolution, and I've just captured a portion of the evolution of the hemagglutinin, and there is a characteristic, very slender evolutionary tree for influenza A viruses, where we have the circulation of a particular antigenic variant until antibody pressure pushes the virus to evolve, and then we have the emergence of a new antigenic variant during seasonal circulation. And sometimes we are incredibly challenged to get the vaccine strains right in the vaccine. In one particular case in 1999, we knew precisely what virus we wanted to put in the vaccine. Seven high-growth reassortants were prepared using the Moscow 10 virus and in four different laboratories, and all of the high-growth reassortants were antigenically different from the wild-type Moscow virus that we wanted to use in the vaccine, and we simply couldn't change the strain. So we have these very practical realities. And then on the genome level, we have something called reassortment, where we have the exchange of gene segments between two or more influenza viruses. And of course, we have compensatory mutations occurring. If you have mutations in the hemagglutinin, you may need to have compensatory mutations in the neuraminidase, so that these two proteins, which are so crucial to the life cycle of the virus, can work efficiently together. So now let's move to the pandemic. We have the timeline for testing the first clinical samples. As you know, April 15th was a big day, not just tax day. The first specimen arrived at CDC and it tested positive for swine influenza using our NP primers and probes, but very weakly for H1 swine, and so we immediately started to sequence the genes of that virus. On April 17, the second specimen arrived, and we had partial sequences analyzed for eight gene segments of the two viruses, which indicated that there was a very unique gene combination. The genes were closest to those of influenza viruses, previously detected in swine in North America, as well as some that had been seen only in Eurasia. So we had a new reassortant. By April 18th, we'd sequenced all 8 gene segments of one of our reference viruses, and we made a decision to clean our good laboratory practices lab so that we could prepare a vaccine candidate at CDC. We had virus isolates in eggs very quickly, and we were able to test them in tests to determine how closely related they were to some of the viruses that we had seen before, which had infected humans, and how closely related they were to the H1N1 seasonal virus. By April 24th, we had total genome sequences for 4 viruses from 3 patients and a total of 8 US cases. So on Thursday, April 16th, we had a pretty good idea that the California virus was really quite different. You can see on this evolutionary tree that the California virus, which is shown in red, is on a rather long branch of the evolutionary tree, and that it was closely related, or reasonably closely related, to some swine influenza viruses that had infected humans before, which are shown in blue under the brackets, North American swine. And you can see that these viruses, the North American swine influenza virus hemagglutinins, are very different from those of the seasonal influenza viruses that were circulating, and different from avian influenza viruses that are of the H1 subtype and Eurasian swine influenza viruses. We also had a phylogenetic tree of the M gene, and we got a very different view of what was going on. We saw right away that the California 4 virus belonged to the same group of viruses as Eurasian swine influenza AH1N1 viruses. So we were able, by looking at the first and second cases, to determine that we did have this novel virus and that it had gene components from 4 different viruses and had resulted in from a whole variety of reassortment events. But most notable, the hemagglutinin, the nuclear protein, and the non-structural genes had been introduced into pigs in 1918 and had circulated in pigs since that time. When we were looking at the origin of the influenza of the 2009 H1N1 virus, we noticed that there were gaps in the available information on swine influenza viruses. There were only 339 European swine influenza gene sequences for all of the swine influenza viruses that had been analyzed. Very little data. If you look at how much human data we have, human influenza virus data we have, it's enormous. We had a tiny amount of information. For swine influenza viruses from the U.S. and Canada, we only had 249 gene sequences, 204 from Asia, and 0 isolates that were in GenBank from Latin America and Africa. And this really limited our understanding of the origin of these viruses. And we have now we're working very closely with USDA to pilot swine influenza virus surveillance. And we see that there'll be potential benefits for animal health by improving vaccine strain selection for the vaccines that are used for pigs and to improve influenza virus diagnostics. And there is swine influenza surveillance being implemented and expanded in some countries around the world besides the United States. So if we look just at the difference in the hemagglutinin between seasonal H1N1, shown in green at the bottom, in the 2009 H1N1 hemagglutinin shown at the top, we could pretty much say that it is unlikely, based on our experience with seasonal influenza viruses, that seasonal vaccines will actually protect against these new viruses. However, we wanted to look more closely at the hemagglutinin, and this is a space-filling structure showing the hemagglutinin shape, the contour at the surface. The bottom of this structure is what attaches to the virus particle, and the top is the business end of the molecule that attaches to the host cell and that changes antigenically. So we compared it to the seasonal Brisbane 59 virus and found that it had only about 73% identity. However, when we considered only the potential antibody accessible residues shown in red, the identity was reduced to 52%. So again, our early assessment was that the immune response to current vaccines would probably not be effective. Our antigenic analysis also confirmed that. And here we have the H1N1 viruses shown in the block in the center of this, in the center of this slide. And you can see that with the high numbers, you have close homology antigenically. When there's a big mismatch between the numbers, such as you see when you are looking at the California 7 and at the top, and then you move down the column and you look at the Brisbane 59 virus at the bottom, you see that there's very little cross-reactivity. This was additional direct evidence that there wouldn't be a good match. Fortunately, these viruses have not really evolved very quickly, and we have developed a way to map the antigenic relatedness of viruses using antigenic cartography, which is much like regular map making. All of the viruses that are inside the green circle, represented by the different colored dots, the colors represent different areas of the world, are good matches to the California 7 vaccine virus. So there's been very little antigenic variation, even to the present. And some of those few small dots outside the green circle, which represent viruses that are a little bit farther out and wouldn't be considered to be such a good match, are older viruses, or viruses with specific mutations that we know confer antigenic variation. But these are very rare, and there's no pattern to their emergence or spread. So then we wanted to go on to look at human serum and look for cross-reactive antibody in the serum of individuals who had received seasonal influenza vaccine. So we used a couple of techniques that measure antibody, and we found that less than 4% of persons born after 1980 had cross-reactive antibodies at a reasonable titer that might be expected to be protective, and 34% of those born before 1950 had what we would consider to be potentially protective titers. Vaccination with the trivalent seasonal vaccine resulted in a fourfold or greater increase in cross-reactive antibody, which we would consider to be a good indication of protection, in only 2% or less of children 6 months to 9 years of age, and in only 12 to 22% of adults 18 to 65 years of age. So these results were not different whether we used adjuvanted vaccine or unadjuvanted seasonal vaccine. So when we look at the timeline of availability of reagents and vaccines, what we know now is that the first cases were identified retrospectively in Mexico on February 24th. The first case was identified in the US on April 15th. We had our first full genomes completed shortly thereafter. We had our egg isolates ready to send to the labs that make the high growth reassortants for influenza vaccine production on April 26th. We began shipping the first real-time PCR diagnostic kits to state health labs on the 29th, and we shared our diagnostic assay and our full genome sequencing strategy and primers with the rest of the world. And then we're able to ship the first diagnostic kits to the WHO network by May 3rd. And then by May 23rd, we were able to begin shipping our vaccine strains to influenza vaccine manufacturers. So it looks fantastic from this point of view. We really did a good job. But then we want to superimpose these dates on the epidemic curve, or our surrogate for an epidemic curve, which is the number of influenza viruses that were identified in patient specimens. And here's what we see. Everything went along swimmingly until we reach the period where we're getting into the end of May. WHO posted the biocontainment risk assessment only on June 19th. And influenza vaccine manufacturers were then able to begin making vaccines, where if they had a BSL 3 facility, they could begin to make them earlier. And then we have only about 11 or 12 weeks before influenza activity began to ramp up. And we can see that the first doses of vaccine were available after we were already seeing increases, significant increases in influenza activity very early for an influenza season. This represents pandemic, the red represents the H1N1 pandemic influenza virus detections. So you can see that the vaccine manufacturers had an enormous challenge. If we look even more closely, we can see that there are so many different things that have to be done from the time a new virus is isolated or identified until vaccine can become available. There you can see it at the end of the slide down at the bottom in the orange box on October 5th, the beginning of vaccination, when the first doses of vaccine became available in the US. In many countries, vaccine did not become available until considerably later, and their curve looks even worse because they didn't have their first vaccine until well after the peak of activity. But in between the time that the vaccine manufacturers receive the vaccine viruses, potency testing reagents have to be prepared, and these are the reagents that are required for determining how much vaccine goes into each vial. And then they develop their working, so that process is undertaken by the central regulatory labs, including the FDA and other labs around the world. In addition, the vaccine manufacturers have to make their working seeds. They have to keep trying to get the vaccine viruses to grow better. And they had a huge challenge with yields of only 30 to 50% of the usual yields for influenza A viruses. The vaccine manufacturers have to test the monovalent concentrates. They had to pool the concentrates. They have to wait for the regulatory agencies to release. They have to fill and finish the vaccine. And then they have to do a lot of safety testing and sterility testing. Of course, during this period of time, clinical trials were being undertaken by NIH, and we were waiting for the results of those clinical trials with bated breath. And I can't tell you the relief that we all had when we found out that a 15 microgram dose of influenza vaccine was going to be suitable for this new virus. So, in thinking back about what happened and how we could make it better next time, I'd like to suggest that there are incremental improvements that could really change the game. And there are really two simple steps. First of all, we want to move the recognition of the outbreak at least 2 weeks earlier. That would have been on the 9th of April. That's not too much to ask. That could have been done through better diagnostics and surveillance preparedness. Now we know we've rolled out our real-time PCR. We've done a tremendous amount of training with our partners around the world. And many more countries can identify and subtype influenza viruses and are aware that unsubtypable viruses, influenza viruses, raise a huge red flag for investigation. We know that we can be prepared for the likely new pandemic threats, such as H2 viruses, H4 viruses, and so on, and we can undertake risk assessment to decide which ones of those pandemic threats are the greatest. And then moving on to improving vaccine production, I think we could move availability of vaccine 4 to possibly even 8 weeks earlier through developing better growing vaccine viruses and through streamlining production of potency testing reagents. And we have some very good ideas about how to do that and to work with our partners. But in spite of these good ideas that we have, we need to act very quickly because we have a new player in the field, the pandemic vaccine. And then we can't forget that we have all of these other pandemic threats. And the next pandemic threat may not wait 40 years. This new H1N1 virus has surprised us in many ways. It has been able to infect pigs, which was really no real surprise, but then it went on to infect turkeys, cheetahs, and cats, and dogs, and ferrets. Although ferrets were not so much of a surprise, it was a big surprise to see cats and dogs infected. So to meet future challenges, we must tend to the vaccine garden, the influenza vaccine garden. And we need to be thinking about what comes next. So we want to look at approaches beyond egg and cell-based vaccine. We know that there are genetic vaccines, which are non-replicating. There are DNA or other nucleic acid vaccines that it could encode the HA and the NA and other proteins if desired. They're recombinant protein vaccines made in a whole variety of different types of cells. Recombinant virus-like particle vaccines, which are very promising, but difficult to produce in some cases. and recombinant live replicating vaccines where you have a viral or a bacterial antigen delivery vector. And then you have various combinations of the above, where you could have prime boost with a DNA or a vaccinia influenza virus and mix that with an adjuvant. We have a pretty strict criteria for new vaccines. First of all, we need to know the mechanism of action and the duration of immunity. We have to have the route of administration and the number of doses figured out. A new vaccine has to be safe and have regulatory acceptability. And we need to know the vulnerability of each new type of influenza vaccine to antigenic drift. And of course, the antigen can change over time, so we have to have scalability and a rapid cycle to change as the antigen changes. So we've done a lot of exploration, and what we found is that there's no one obvious winning approach, but there are many promising new technologies and new companies in the mix. And so we also realized that there are safety and regulatory issues that have become a major deterrent for investment in advanced clinical development. So there's sort of the valley of death between discovery of new potential influenza vaccines, which occurs mainly through NIH funding, and the time that a new vaccine can actually be approved by FDA. And we're seeing now that there's a potential for a government role in promoting development of new influenza vaccines. And there may be ways that we can work together to incentivize manufacturing technology development and clinical trials. So here we are at the end of wave two in the Northern Hemisphere, and 1 year since the emergence of the H1N1 pandemic virus. Over 17,700 laboratory-confirmed deaths have been reported to WHO by all the countries shown in pink. We know this is a gross underestimate of the true number of deaths. But we've learned a lot of lessons from the H1N1 pandemic. Having influenza vaccines even 4 to 6 weeks earlier would be likely to make a huge difference in disease reduction and in vaccine acceptance. If the threat of a disease has somewhat passed, fewer people are going to take the vaccine. There's no doubt about it. In spite of all odds, 70 to 80 million doses of monovalent pandemic vaccine were administered in the United States. We actually did much, much better than any other country, and I'm very proud of that and of all of my colleagues in this room and in the States who worked so very hard. So for the future, we want to set our goals. We want to move the detection of novel influenza viruses closer to emergence and the availability of vaccines closer to disease occurrence, and to actually have them before the main peak of disease. So what do we need to do? We need sustainable multi-use respiratory disease surveillance platforms for identification of novel virus emergence globally and novel pathogen emergence, not just influenza. We also need to work very closely with our colleagues who work on bacterial vaccines because we need to know the burden of all of the respiratory diseases. We need to have a library of truly high-growth reassortants tested and production-ready and in a stockpile. We need to streamline this complicated process of measuring the amount of antigen in a vaccine dose and make it suitable for for all HA protein vaccines, so it's a common platform. We really need to consider the use of adjuvants for antigen sparing and to produce a more robust immune response, particularly for a pandemic that might have a greater severity than the one we've just experienced. And we need to improve vaccine capacity globally for vaccine equity throughout the world. Of course, we need to continue to enhance our partnerships domestically and globally. Now, I'd like to acknowledge so many people. I won't go through the whole list, but I really would like to acknowledge our state and local health departments and the Department of Defense Laboratories. We work so closely with our state and local partners throughout the pandemic, and the response was so dependent on them, as well as other public health colleagues around the world. I'd also like to acknowledge our other U.S. Government agencies, sister agencies with whom we work so closely, FDA and NIH, our colleagues in veterinary medicine, and of course the WHO's Global Influenza Surveillance Network, which is essential for all of our influenza vaccine recommendations and for our response. And finally, I'd like to acknowledge all of the influenza division staff and countless others at CDC, many of whom are in this room, Ann Shuckett, Steve Redd, and many, Beth, I don't know if you're here, Beth Bell, and many, many others who worked their hearts out during this H1N1 pandemic response. So thank you very much for your attention. We have a challenge.
Nancy, thank you so much for an outstanding lecture. We so enjoyed it and enjoyed having you. You know, this is the 14th year and 14th anniversary of the Gerald Lynn Hilleman lecture. And so, Nancy, you've added not only one more name to the list, but you've added additional status to the list of our outstanding speakers. So thank you for doing that. We want to give you a certificate of appreciation to say thanks. And please help me again. Thank you so much. Well, you know, these lectures don't just happen. They're put together by a very hardworking staff from Merck and CDC and the CDC Foundation. I want to particularly thank several people for their work in helping make these lectures such a success, starting with Julie Smith from the CDC Foundation, as well as Courtney Bartels from the CDC Foundation. Raise your hand or stand up if you're in the audience, Julie. And also Suzanne Johnson de Leon. Suzanne, are you here? Thanks to all of you for fantastic work putting this together.